Okay, thank you all for joining, as this is intended as a 30-minute conversation, hybrid conversation with our colleagues and partners, Kubu in Finland. Shout out here to Tuomo Tampana, who is supporting the hosting. This series is part of a collaboration with Kubu and the Social Practice Lab at Winchester School of Art and the University of Southampton. The series of talks is in keeping with the Elemental Thread program, which kicked off last year in association also with Kubu, with 2025 being the Earth year and this year being our year of water. We have a monthly series of conversations that started last month and will run to December. And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague and co-thinker now, I would say, for some years, Andreas Philippopoulos. Miha Popoulos, and I hope I have done justice to your name, Andreas, which has a wonderful ring and a sound to it. But thank you for joining us. Andreas is the director of the Westminster Law and Theory Lab. He is an artist and performer and has published last year Hydro Justice, which is what we will be speaking about today. Alongside his work as an artist and as a scholar, he's known for his groundbreaking work, I would say, in thinking about spatial justice, in particular then from an environmental theme, and supports many strands of work that bridge shared interests across ritual, environmental humanities, post-human legal scholarship, and radical thinking, I would say, in notions of love and space, and flow, which we will discuss a little bit in more detail. Andreas, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm
Yeah, I want to say I almost poured, to give a watery word to reading your book on Hydro Justice, into the cells of my body in the last few days. And for those who may not be familiar with your work, I think it would be useful maybe to position how Hydro Justice relates to your previous work, in terms of spatial justice and how you actually define that field of practice. And then we'll move on to how you locate then the hydra within that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, first of all, because it's quite delightful to be part of the water year. It sounds like a new Chinese horoscope. I'm delighted to float along. Hydro Justice was a little bit of a turn in terms of moving from a slightly more, may I say, juridical or perhaps adversarial way of thinking on which spatial justice was placed. The way I define spatial justice was that no two bodies can ever occupy the same space at the same time, and that harks back to ancient Greek philosophy. But the whole point was that there's always a moment of competition and of pushing out. But I've never been particularly happy with it because I realized that what I was always trying to do in my life, and this is very much of a personal thing, is to flow. And to try and find ways in which various bodies can accommodate each other in flow, but also against each other's flow. And so Hydro Justice was born, in a sense, as a need to address this polymorphy of different flows. Now, both of these versions of justice refer to the elemental. Spatial justice had a lot, strangely, had a lot to do with air rather than earth, because I was dealing with atmospherics, and spatial justice goes through the element of air in order to define itself and sort of, has a chance of emerging. Hydro justice obviously is water, but then water somehow becomes this full elemental cycle. So, of course, the transformation of the continuum between the various forms of water, from the solid to the gas to I've tried to include in that movement, that gesture of hydro justice. So I imagine hydro justice to be somehow seemingly a more convivial way of thinking about justice, but at the same time, rather cruel. And we can talk about where the cruelty of hydro justice lies in a minute.
Thank you. I think I really appreciate there how you located it, as I mentioned, in relation to your work in spatial justice. And to expand then on this kind of cruelty in a way, you speak about the book trying to in a way, speak to the agency of water taking over, in a sense, and how water, in a sense, actually represents, and I think this is what you're getting at there too, the way things are and the way things carry on, in a sense. So there's this ontological position that you're putting forward in a way. And actually, much of our work and our conversations over the last couple of years were around that ontological position. What does it mean to actually shift, particularly around kind of practices in relation to ritual, which is something that you address in the book. But going back to this sort of, I guess, challenge, or what do you sort of see then as the cruelty, perhaps, in hydro justice
I
and
think
this,
justice. Sorry, Karen.
No, you go, you go.
Cruelty of interruptions. There's a well, I think the cruelty in this sense is in hydro justice is precisely the non-interrupted. As you said, hydro justice somehow has always been around. It's not something that one can reach. Spatial justice carried the promise of the future of the emergence. Hydro justice in many ways is something that has always been around, and for this reason it becomes entirely non-human. I mean, humans are part of this, but the way that I understand hydro justice as a planetary moment of flow amongst various bodies of water, which are everything, is a body of water, whether human, non-human, conceptual, etc. And this is obviously drawing on hydrofeminism and Astrida Ney-Manes's work. That cruelty is that things can carry on and do carry on without us. So what happens when we observe a planet that can survive even despite us? And will leave us behind at some point, and will carry on in its beautiful blue. One of the little sort of, let's say, translating linguistic devices I'm using is to move from calling the planet Earth to the planet Hydrogeus. And Hydrogeus comes from Greek, and obviously it's Hydra and Earth, Gaia. But I think giving precedence to the water and understanding how the water takes over. And will take over at some point, and that's it's not fine, but it's what it is. So the cruelty is a sort of a melancholy of the humanity, the way we know it.
And an acceptance then, in a sense, to death too, one could argue. But to go back, I guess, to this point where you say that the hydro justice is always there, I think this goes back to this core elemental aspect of water, that it is present in all bodies, in a sense. There's and so just to make sure that we're, I guess, on the same plane, so to speak, here, and I'd like to go into planes in more detail with the horizontal in a second, but that's what you mean by the hydra has always been there, in that water is contained in so many. It's a core element in the matrix of life, as it's called.
It is, but it's not. It doesn't take necessarily precedence over other elements. I don't. I'm not so much interested in that. I'm interested in almost a kind of a perspectival ontological take. So I'm not interested in providing a sort of like a bird's eye view or Artemis Artemis spaceship kind of a view of what is happening with the elements and which one takes precedence. But it's really interesting to start thinking about justice in elemental ways. And in order to do that, one needs to look into different elements to start with, and then understanding justice as just emplacement.
Thank you. And going, I guess, further into that, planes and perspectives and positions, in the sense of spatial. One of the things that, so for those who may not have read the book, and this is my reading of the work, I love the way that it laps and ebbs and flows into these sort of kind of, concrete classic chapters that we would expect in the book, and then it kind of laps out into this way of writing as a methodology, which we will talk about in a few seconds, and you sort of experiment with that through these interstitial chapters that kind of come in, and they're in a different font, and they're in a different itel etc. etc. And it's kind of this notion then, of course, of writing with water, or becoming with water, that you're actually exercising. But before we kind of go there, in a way, one of our previous conversation with Julia Champman, an ocean governance scholar and blue humanities scholar at the university here, spoke about writing and thinking in this tidalic way, in a sense, and you speak to the ontodontic, is it that in your work, in terms of the surface of the oceans and dipping. So I'm really liking this kind of like perspective, this mental space that your work and Julia's work is bringing us into, which then articulates itself in your manifesto, which you speak to against the vertical, embracing the horizontal, and the diagonal. Could you expand really on about what you kind of mean around all of these things? I feel like going like this at the same time.
Yeah,
It's like
no, I know
raving.
that it helps. While I was conducting, but horizontality for me is very important because, in a sense, it opposes self to horizontal to verticality. Verticality, I very briefly associated with almost like the human hubris, starting from the Babel Tower, and well, not even starting with the human actually lifting themselves up on the hind legs and moving. That's a moment of distance from the thing that essentially attracts us. And I am not advocating and going on all fours, but what I'm trying to reimagine is what happens when the surface takes over. And I'm really interested in this horizontality because not for the obvious, just for the obvious reasons of fairness and equal distribution, etc. Of course, that too. But essentially because almost like a metaphor of flat Earth, we can no longer talk about crisis. We are actually seeing ourselves being almost kicked off the edge of the Earth. We are ruining what we're doing in the Earth, and this is not just an ecological cry. It's a planetary tilt, and as such, we can only concentrate on moving away from this manic verticality, whether it's fracking, whether it's trying to, all the things that, building higher or bombing lower, etc. But and then move to this moment of confluence on the horizontal. And of course, the diagonal comes from Deleuze and Guattari, which is about freeing the diagonal, finally finding a way of connecting the various things and taking a line of flight away from it. Now, interestingly, wave writing is, as you thank you for reading it so closely, because it is the mode of writing for the whole book. And that came, I had practiced wave writing in the past, whether as writing or as workshops or in some of my performances. But for this book particularly, the brief from the publisher, from Polity, was to be a very short book. So it is about 20, 30, 25 or 30. I think I managed to push it up to 30,000 words, which for chatty academics like us, it was an ordeal. And so I had to really be pithy. And also, it's a very trendy series, this one, with beautiful covers and an extraordinary editor, Laurent de Sutet. And so I really needed to up my trend and go all. And so I decided to go and distill everything into these almost tidalectics, almost tides that come in and then share the same surface for a moment and then go back. Now, interestingly, though, I'm also quite local in my way of understanding water. I'm from the Mediterranean, from Greece, rather than the big ocean. And so I don't understand tides. The Mediterranean are quite small. I understand tides a bit more in Venice, where I also spend time, because you can see that, but they don't come like this, they come differently. So what I was trying to do with this wave writing is actually thinking about very slow lapping waves that come and rather than big planetary movements that organize everything.
Thank you for sharing that, because as a sensibility, I think I really felt I picked that up, because you, inside also of those sort of more, let's say, classic type of chapter structures, there's also multiple storylines. There's literature, there's philosophy, there's art. You tell us about your own personal experience of growing up with water, your fear of water. And I think that that sort of like creates these little mini currents in each of the chapters as well. That was really, really, really
Beautiful.
beautiful, you know? So thank you. For those, though, that might be interested in trying to, I guess, embrace other ways of going back to this ontological shift that we know that we sort of need in a sense. How does wave rising, like, what are your ways of stepping into that wave rising moment? You know, is there preparations that you are willing to share, or maybe have, or rituals that you have
I knew you were
actually,
going to say rituals.
yes, of course, you know, but that you have maybe.
I wrote the majority of the book. I wrote it in Venice, and I was very fortunate to be able to work in a place where I could have direct view of the lagoon. That's just an incredible privilege, and of course, I'm not saying that you have to see water in order to write that, but this was a little ritual of mine. So the space in which I could write, and I would curl up in a very uncomfortable position. I would stay there for the whole day and but I think wave writing is also a way of looking inside, and it's very important to work through almost psychotherapeutic methods in order to bring out some stuff that might be quite difficult. So you mentioned my fear of water. Now it's very paradoxical for somebody who professes to be obsessed with water and writing about water and justice and all stuff to also, and pretty much on the same breath, say that I'm actually afraid of water, and I am. And that took a little bit of guts to bring out. And I think that's important to think in terms of wave writing, that wave writing is something that goes in and then goes out again and then goes deeper in. And it has a cleansing but also very eroding aspect to it. So it's not, again, there's a cruelty in that. Wave writing can happen in many, many, many ways. And I love the idea of doing it collectively. That is, with a group of people where there's we share sheets of paper where a story starts being written by, say, one group, and then it moves very quickly to the other one, and the other one has to carry on with that story. And then we have like seven different stories coming and circulating at the same time. So you have to respect the story, the sheet. At the same time, you have to respect the group and how it's right. So this is just one method of wave writing. But I think another moment of wave writing in the book, which is it has become the central tenet of a, because I've devised several performances around the book. And one of the performances is called the Hydro Contract, and it refers to, and it uses at least parts of the final wave writing moment, which is a contract, a speculative contract with amongst bodies of water. And this contract uses juridical language. It's very legalese. I have access to that. So I can easily draw on that. But at the same time, it creates a speculative planetary moment of flow. In fact, I call it a polyamorous shared flow, where the various bodies come together, flow together, and in a sense bind themselves in this, what I describe, non-binding contract. And so part of the performance is that I go through that. In fact, I chant through it. So it's very ritualistic. I have almost like a private liturgy when I'm going through this with some extraordinary props and clothes designed by Marta von Kranach, her designer here in Venice and Vienna, which help really go into that kind of very different flow. And very many rituals that connect everyone. Well, I hope I'm connecting to everyone while going chanting through the various parts of the contract. And then at the end, there's a moment where people are invited to sign this non-binding contract. I think to me, this is a way of writing of bringing practices, disciplines, modes, gestures, waves, bodies of water together.
Thank you. I think that's giving a kind of a sense in a way of both how the continual practice, your scholarship, your performance practice, your artistic practice actually kind of come together. Maybe it might be useful that I just read one of the extracts from the contract, because there's 10 parts. So I'm going to read the one on horizontality. All waters aim at the horizontality of doing and becoming. Verticality is discouraged. Unequal affective powers are to be treated with gentleness. Fragility is to be cherished. Part 5 of the contract. which I think I would sign. So that's just to give those listening a sort of an example of the, I would say, poetic and the kind of contractual languages that you're sort of activating in this. But one of the other kind of reoccurring thoughts in this, and you have touched upon it already, is this ethics of shared flow. And I was just wondering if you could expand on that, because I thought, again, in thinking through what are these ontological positions that we need to practice and inhabit and think about in order to create the change of living in a more companion way with our earth, then, you know, this idea of the ethics of shared flow felt really, I would say, at the heart of the matter in some ways. And what's your position on that? Or
Positions,
please
really,
share.
because it is about positions. It's about positioning oneself in relation to other bodies. It's a Spinozan idea. The Spinozan ethics is all about how to place oneself in relation to other bodies without harming other bodies, but also by connecting to all the bodies that you can without necessarily different. I mean, that's debatable, but without necessarily differentiating between the intimate, the close, the nearby, and the ones far off. It also connects with a term that I've used, that I've picked up from various strands of philosophy and also oceanography, called the clines. And so the way that different, or the clinamen in the philosophical terms, which means different flows of water. Imagine slices, thick slices of semi-transparent water of difference coming together and yet managing to slide next to each other without mixing. And that, I mean, of course, this can be explained because of a difference in temperature, etc. But the beauty of this is that there is this possibility coming together but without becoming one, but never forgetting that you're already part of this one. So it's Spinozan through and through. And the ethics of shared flow is sort of, I'm doing a Hydro-Spinozan dive and thinking of Spinoza as floating amongst other bodies of water, and how this shared flow that, as I said, can be with, along, but also against one another can operate. Essentially, how do we resolve differences? Because it's not about being flat, it's not about being the same, it's not about being always in harmony. It's about finding ways of resolving the difference and the dispute and the violence and all that stuff. And sometimes violence is needed and is part of it. But then the whole point is how do you return to this ethics of shared flow without forgetting that you're a part of it, and that whatever you do, you'll be. The future is very watery. So, yeah.
I think there's no, I mean, the world that we're living in at this moment, this feels, the ethics of shared flow feels very important in a sense. And I think that, again, returning to the points of connect between our work, we sort of see ritual as a way through that, in or as a practice of that. So I think perhaps at another point it would be really nice to expand a bit more on those connects around ritual. But I am conscious of time, and you know, the intention is that these sessions are also in this, like, sort of lunchtime break and a hybrid conversation. But to close, really, there's two points I'd like to kind of pull out, really. And one is that there's moments that you also repeat within the book about this point on in terms of crisis. Yes, we are using a language at the moment of polycrisis, of compounded crisis, and you speak to this sort of anti-crisis moment in a way, and that it's not useful. And I would like you to kind of expand on that, because I think for some people it is important to sort of name a crisis and to say that these are these intersectional poly situations that we are in that are kind of compounding effects upon the body and our societies. So again, just for, I guess, clarity and those listening, what's your point, your argument here in saying that we need to move beyond this kind of language of crisis? And to close, then, I would sort of like to, you know, I know your optimistic stance and this wonderful way that you speak also of that position really early on in the book in terms of where you sort of see your work lying. So it'd be nice to also share where you are going next with your work.
Oh,
And yes, yeah.
so yeah, I mean the Antichrist thing, Janet Reutman famously wrote the work on Antichrist, and that's precisely the flow I'm following, in the sense that I don't think that talking about crisis helps anymore. Of course, there's never been an epoch in history where we weren't in some sort of crisis or other. So okay, fine, we can always be in that kind of heightened neurotic state. And we are. It's okay. So what? And so what I'm interested in is understanding it as moments of nodes of evolution, of nodes of and when I say evolution, I mean personal, emotional, planetary evolution. So we become better through all these conflicts and through all these moments of as you said, poly compounding on the body. There's no doubt that, I mean, I don't know, I feel my body really compounded with so many things and from so many different materialities, and that's very hard. I also, though, and this is where the optimism comes in, that I'm focused, I'm determined. I don't even know, I think I was born like that. I'm not even trying to, it's not a mental switch. I cannot advise anyone to do that. It's just, I'm focusing on the silver lining. I'm focusing always on the, even if the silver lining is about the end of humanity, in a sense, you know, a new humanity. I mean, I call it the hydro human there, and that works together with my fiction work, my recent novel called Our Distance Became Water, where, without spoilers, there is this open horizon of horizontality, where the hydro human becomes somehow closer to the surface of the nocturnal lagoon.
Can I just also kind of just to intersect there in your flow, because I was also struck by how in that kind of crisis you also drew on many Black scholars across the book in terms of actually and particularly was enjoyed the nod to underground resistance and the kind of imaginaries from where some of the kind of aqua the new aqua kind of human kind of came from as a form of resistance. So in a way, where do you kind of place also those histories in a sense of where water has been weaponized and water is not it's the grave in a sense for many and reconcile that then with this more, I would say, hopeful turn that you're kind of placing us within.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the weaponization of water has always been racial, has always been embodied, has always been gendered, sexual, and it, just like everything else, just like every violence. And it's not just a question of intense manifestation. It's actually an kind of it, this racialization of water historically and now is part of the ontology of water. And it's really frightful. So it is true. I mean, I could have written an immensely long book on hydro injustice. I've chosen to focus, and that's because the volume had to be slim, on hydro justice. Now, jokes apart, I think it's very important for me to look for moments where justice emerges. So when the shared flow actually takes place, and where the bodies can, whether it's speculatively. I tried to find a moment of hydro justice even at the Zonk, you know, the boat crossing the ocean, and it's very hard, and I think it was a very difficult gesture to try and put that together, and I hope I did it well, because one fears of where one dives and where one lands, and but I to me it's very, very important to continue with this, as you called it, resistance, and I call it simply the state of hydrojustice that has been somehow covered up by the debris of all those extractivism, colonialism, imperialism, all those things that have been weighing it down. But that doesn't mean that it's not there. It's like, as we know, there is water in the core of the earth, and I adore this nexus about how there's water in the core of the earth, and then there is this line of light that connects to water between planets, floating around, never to become a rain, yet always connected to the planet's core. That to me is hydrogestasis, and it's very hopeful.
And I can't think of a better way to end. Right on time at 14:01. Andrews, thank you so much. It's always great to riff with you, and I hope we'll see you soon in the next coming months. And thanks to colleagues and friends and those who have joined us. The next session will be on May the 21st. We have Kajal Modi, who will be joining, speaking about her work on water and pollution and microbes. Same time, same place, same link. And thank you all. And thanks to Kubu and Tumo and Sari for hosting, as always, the sessions. This particular conversation was part of the Year of Water and the Elemental Programme. Collaboration from the Social Practice Lab at Winchester School of Art and Kubu. So, thank you all and see you soon.